4. Red Hombre. January 2012 through February 2012. In search of sun that winter, the kingpin Chapo Guzman went on a holiday in Cabo San Lucas, flying in to the fabled beach resort on a private plane that landed in the cactus-studded hills above the coastal strip of luxury hotels. Joining him was one of his most trusted aides, his bodyguard and secretary, Carlos Hu Ramirez, a former helicopter pilot with a brush cut and a slim English mustache. Hu Ramirez, better known as Condor, had been at Guzman's side for years, watching his back, handling his phone calls, and generally clearing paths around him. Lodging for the two men had been arranged by an advance team in a split-level, salmon-colored mansion with a large perimeter garden and a red-tiled roof at the end of a cul-de-sac in Punta Ballena, one of Cabo's most exclusive, gated communities. The vacationers were traveling light, with only a cook, a pilot, and a gardener in their entourage. Guzman had demanded that a treadmill be installed in the house for daily exercise, but other than that, there was not much to distract him. A deck with lounge chairs, a teardrop swimming pool, and glittering ocean views. After 10 years of living in the mountains, the kingpin had grown weary of his secluded highland camps. Whenever his safety and schedule permitted it, he loved slipping off to havens like Los Cabos, where he could eat well, drink among his friends, and have his pick of the local professional talent. Now is a good time to have gotten away. In recent weeks, the bloodshed and beheadings of his expansionary war in Juarez had started to devolve into a frustrating stalemate. At the same time, a new conflict with a new foe, his former allies, the Jalisco New Generation Cartel, was slowly heating up in Guadalajara. Not more than a month or two ago, Guzman had gotten word that 26 of his men had been slaughtered in Guadalajara, their bodies heaped into 3 vans parked near the Millennium Arches. Nearly simultaneously, another 16 soldiers had been discovered burned to death, some of them in handcuffs, in Culiacan. On Christmas Day, the army had arrested one of his top security chiefs, Felipe Cabrera. Then there was the nastiness involving his cousin Juancho. In Cabo, he could forget about all that, or try to. When Guzman arrived in the city, he shed his mountain camouflage and made his way through the palm-treed streets in blue jeans, Nikes, and a baseball hat. Behind the tinted windows of his gold Suburban, however, the sports pack he carried was still filled cautiously with hand grenades. Condor accompanied him everywhere he went, with a launcher tucked in his guitar case. 3 days after the revelation that they had Chapo Guzman's BlackBerry pin, Marston Patash and Christian Rodriguez boarded a flight to Mexico City. The spur-of-the-moment trip had been prompted by a phone call that the FBI agents made to their counterpart at SOD in the wake of their discovery. It was a courtesy call, or so they thought, to let the team at the DEA know that they were right. According to the Bureau's intercepts, the BlackBerry was in fact connected to the kingpin. The call, in turn, had set off a windstorm that had blown from Chantilly through Washington, D.C., all the way down to Mexico and back in less than 70 hours. Though Marston and Patash didn't know the details, they soon found out the bottom line: the DEA, leveraging the BlackBerry pin, had drawn a bead on Guzman and was planning a raid. A meeting had been set up, pending their arrival at the embassy. First, however, Marston and Patash booked Rodriguez into a hotel. They didn't want to march their confidential source through the front door of one of the most public buildings in the city. Since leaving Manhattan, Rodriguez had been furiously working on his laptop, monitoring Guzman's FlexiSpy accounts for any breaking intelligence. Once they settled into their rooms, he gave his handlers the good news and the bad. The good news was that it seemed as if the kingpin hadn't gotten wise to their surveillance and was still using the pin in their possession to send chats back and forth. The bad news was it was impossible to know with any certainty if the physical device connected to the pin was actually in his hands. Rodriguez had seen the process firsthand. Guzman rarely touched the BlackBerries he used, preferring to have his bodyguards do his texting for him. They, and the BlackBerries, might or might not be standing next to him at any given time. When Marston and Potash arrived at the meeting, they found the usual embassy who's who, the ambassador's staff, the DEA's regional director and his men, and some people from the Bureau's legal attaché team. As the New York agents took a seat, they presented themselves as wanting to be useful. They admitted that they didn't work in Mexico and didn't know the landscape or the players. They also said that they would not presume to insert themselves into the tactical details of a ground operation that required coordination with the Mexican authorities and was, as a drug raid based on foreign soil, the province of their DEA colleagues. They did, however, suggest that they had something valuable to bring to the table, the FlexiSpy data and the expert technician who had managed to collect it. The DEA felt differently. By its lights, Marston and Potash had not come down from New York to offer their assistance in capturing the kingpin. They had instead come down to talk the embassy out of the mission. The agents based in Mexico might indeed have heard the two New Yorkers acknowledge that they weren't versed in Mexican affairs, an opinion they agreed with. But they also heard Potash say that it would be ludicrous to launch a raid on Guzman now, when C-23 was still receiving intelligence on the kingpin, and moreover, had an undercover source in a risky situation in the field. In the DEA's assessment, Marston and Potash had staked out an inflexible position. They seemed to believe that keeping the FlexiSpy data coming in was more important than going after Guzman, since it could ultimately lead to taking down his entire organization. Then again, the DEA's own position was equally unwavering. Possessing information, but failing to use it, they insisted, was an exercise in futility, and they already had their own information, the BlackBerry pin that Juan Sandoval had gotten from the kingpin's girlfriend. This second version of the meeting was not quite the cooperative summit that the first one had seemed to be, and it ended with a few strong words from the DEA. "You can do your own thing if you want, because we're sure as hell going to do ours." January passed in a blur of beachfront business. Though supposedly on vacation, Guzman spent his afternoons and many of his evenings at the house in Punta Ballena, hunched above his BlackBerry. Like any chief executive, he was inundated by messages from the office. Among the swirl of projects that required his attention was a new meth lab he was setting up in Ecuador and a large load of cocaine that was already in transit from an airstrip in Belize. Toward the middle of the month, he checked in with his father-in-law, Ines Coronel, about a different load they were moving through Nogales, Arizona. Guzman advised him to situate his couriers correctly and to please stay off the radio since the Border Patrol was listening. A few weeks after that, he was dealing with an issue in Detroit, where his local cell needed more storage for their inventory and handling the fallout from a hitch in San Diego. One of his truck drivers there had somehow lost the keys to a trailer full of merchandise, setting back delivery. In Phoenix, meanwhile, longtime clients had reached out with an urgent order for weed. Even as he struggled to fulfill the request, he learned that one of his panga boats had been seized off the coast of Santa Barbara. When he subsequently found out that three of his boatmen had also been arrested, he started making arrangements to find them lawyers. All of this and more was on top of the domestic matters he was dealing with at home. Earlier that winter, he and his wife Emma had started making plans to build a house in Culiacán, a trophy mansion with a master suite, three guest bedrooms, and quarters for the maid. Every few days, he was on his BlackBerry, reminding her to be sure she told their architect to put high ceilings in their own room and to design the shower with an extra wide stall. In between discussing these instructions, they often found time to talk about their two infant daughters. No, he would not be back to celebrate their birthday, and to share the various details of their private lives. Emma was having trouble deciding on a present for a good friend who had given her her own lavish gift, a $12,000 Rolex. When she asked her husband for a budget, he told her that she shouldn't spend any more than $8,000. While Emma was grateful, she was on a diet preparing for plastic surgery, and it sometimes made her testy. 12:24 p.m. I can't eat and I'm starving. Are you going to chat with me or will you be busy? They mostly lived apart these days, and whenever Emma flew in from Culiacan to visit him in Cabo, she rarely stayed at the house in Punta Ballena. Instead, she stayed with Alex Cifuentes at his own house, a 10,000-square-foot villa across the peninsula in Pueblo Bonito. There, she and her daughters could spread out and enjoy themselves while not intruding on her husband's other business. Alex was busy too, of course, overseeing the Kingpin's roots in Canada and the manuscript project with the writer Javier Rey, who had spent much of the spring and summer working at the property. But unlike his employer, Alex knew how to relax. An amateur astronomer, Alex spent hours each day taking pictures of the sky and many of his nights gazing at the heavens through the high-tech telescope Andrea Vélez had bought him for his birthday. Alex's house was fun and full of visitors, not just Bray and Emma, but the lovely gay couple that Andrea had hired to design the website for Alex's pet side project, a wind-powered real estate development up the coast in Baja. On winter evenings, when Guzman was too caught up to join them, some of the guests would sit for dinner on Alex's rambling deck overlooking Sunset Beach. The meals were spectacular, served by the infinity pool and cooked to perfection by their host's private chef. Finding Guzman, as the DEA well knew, had always been the easy part. Communications were so essential to his operation that there was always surveilled intelligence that could pinpoint his location. The hard part was different, and twofold. First, you had to figure out, once he had been found, if it was even possible to grab him. Then, because of the corruption in the government, you had to determine who in local law enforcement could actually be trusted with the grabbing. As February 2012 hurried toward an end, both questions fell to Victor Vasquez. Vasquez, a veteran agent based at the embassy in Mexico, had been on duty the day Juan Sandoval had called in with his tip about the BlackBerry pin. Though many of his colleagues had been skeptical, Vasquez tended to believe it. He knew Juan Sandoval, had worked with him in San Diego, and trusted him implicitly. A former Marine, Vasquez approached his job at the DEA with a ramrod rigor and a sense of personal mission. He was, after all, a native Mexican, born in Durango, a state that bordered Sinaloa. After talking things over with Sandoval, Vasquez went to work checking out the BlackBerry pin with sources of his own. Within a few days, he had run the information to the ground. It wasn't simple turning pins into locational coordinates, but Vasquez had a man in Guadalajara who, for a price, would quietly run the numbers through the Mexican telephone system. The results came back as a map. On the map, a little red hombre marked the place where the pin had left a ping. When Vasquez got the map for Guzman's pin, he was shocked to find the red hombre standing what seemed to be a condo complex a few miles inland from the coast in Cabo San Lucas. Cabo wasn't Culiacan, the kingpin's stronghold city, and it certainly wasn't the mountains. Cabo was a party town with nightclubs, bars, and million-dollar villas. Christ, thought Vasquez, we could do this. Staring at the red man on his map, he could not believe his luck. The guy was on vacation, taking sun and chasing girls, like every other idiot at the beach. Or perhaps not chasing them. Guzman's girls usually went to him. One of them arrived in Punta Ballena in February, around the time that Emma and his daughters left for home. Slender, dark-haired, and 20 years his junior, Agustina Acosta was a lawyer by profession, but in her year or so of dating Guzman, she had started to perform a different role. The kingpin was always searching for new ways to insulate himself and had a habit of running much of his business through his mistresses. Not long after Agustina met him, she became both his lover and his personal assistant. In many of the projects Guzman was involved in, Agustina handled all the details. Serving as his go-between, she would toggle back and forth on the three separate Blackberries he gave her, fielding questions from his customers and underlings, and responding with his answers when she got them. Already that winter, Agustina had helped her lover set up his meth lab in Ecuador, negotiate the purchase of the chemicals he needed, and supervise the movements of a ton-sized shipment of cocaine to Arizona. When Guzman's panga boat was seized in California, Agustina did the grunt work and looked into the public defender who was representing his boatmen. Ruthless and resourceful, she seemed to have a special knack for cracking the whip on his workers when they shirked or dragged their feet. The screen name she used in her private chats with Guzman was Fiera, the wild beast. Her compensation for all of this often came in the form of personal courtesies. The liposuction treatment, for example, that Agustina underwent, and that Guzman paid for just before she flew to meet him in Cabo. Though she was still recovering from her surgery, her waist hurt to the touch, she landed on Los Cabos International on February 16th and quickly made her way to the house in Punta Ballena. Driving in from the airport, she bantered with the kingpin, coyly priming him for their reunion. "I'm on my way, love. I'll be with you in 10. Agustina was smart, certainly smarter than most of Guzman's girlfriends. She understood his need to be flattered and had no problem lying to him or coddling his ego. Aware of his paranoid nature, she had also assumed from the start that he was spying on her. A week before she checked into the hospital, she confided to a friend that something seemed to be wrong with the three phones he had given her, never suspecting how right she was or how wrong they really were. 5:14 p.m. "I don't trust these Blackberries. The bastard can locate them." Having located the bastard, Vasquez and his colleagues now turned to the second part of their equation, finding someone to go after him in Cabo. Under Mexican law, American agents were not allowed to act alone in ground operations in the country. This traditional restriction required them to work in tandem and to share intelligence with law enforcement partners, whose loyalties were often undiscernible at best. From the embassy's perspective, police work in Mexico was frequently a guessing game, where you had to choose the least untrustworthy counterpart and hope that when you turned around, they didn't simply stab you in the back. It could feel at times like performing surgery through a kind of proxy doctor, one who might have been quietly paid off to kill both you and the patient on the side. After much discussion, Vasquez and his DEA partners settled on a strike force, cobbling one together from the local Cabo SWAT team and a special squad of federal officers who were based in Mexico City. There had been some conversations early in the process about bringing in the Mexican Marines, elite troops from the Navy with a reputation for probity and ruthlessness, but on top of corruption, there were questions about rivalries to consider, and the Marines didn't always get along with the police. Vasquez had to admit it was not ideal, having two separate elements under the command of two separate officers, neither one American, chasing the little red hombre through Los Cabos. Then again, it was not ideal that the FBI had shut their Colombian source in a hotel and refused to bring him anywhere near the embassy. But that was how it always was in Mexico. The tools in the toolbox were simply what they were. In his hotel near the embassy, Christian Rodriguez waited 15 minutes, then pressed refresh again. He knew that FlexiSpy was able to transmit updates from the kingpin's BlackBerry faster than that, at short 5-minute intervals, but he also knew that increments that frequent would probably wreak havoc with its battery. With the capture mission imminent, the young man had been tasked with keeping watch on Guzman's messages and his GPS coordinates through the program. The last thing he wanted was to overplay his hand and cause the kingpin's BlackBerry, the only way to track him, to suddenly go dead. Refresh. Still there. Refresh. Still there. Refresh. Wait. Refresh. Wait. Refresh. At shortly after nightfall, on the evening of February 21st, 200 officers from the Cabo SWAT team and the federal police moved out from their staging grounds at the international airport. Tracking Guzman's BlackBerry PIN, they drove in a convoy toward a gated community of 15 or 20 new adobe homes clustered in a neighborhood near the center of the city, a few miles from the water. As the two police teams made their approach, they were unexpectedly joined by the Mexican Marines, who had belatedly decided that they too wanted to take part in the mission. What had at first been a hybrid operation with two different forces and commanders now had three. When the triple-pronged assault team closed in on its target, armed men from each started going house to house, breaking down doors and hauling people more or less at random onto the street. Back at the embassy, Victor Vasquez and Juan Sandoval waited for a follow-up report from the ground commanders on their group chat. The initial report had been somewhat less than promising. The strike teams, it had been confirmed, had not found Guzman yet, although the search was continuing. As for the residents who had been taken from their homes, it seemed that they were mostly elderly expats from the United States and Canada. Many, in their broken Spanish, had made it clear they weren't pleased. Vasquez and Sandoval didn't get it. They could see the red hombre standing on their map. He was right there, where the police were, where he was supposed to be. The sneaky bastard Guzman must be hiding. Try the closets, they told the commanders. Then try the basements and the kitchen cabinets. Search under the goddamn rugs. He had to be there somewhere. Except he wasn't there. Not at shortly after nightfall, and not hours later at 4 a.m. By the time the mission ended, at a little before dawn, the only thing the teams had discovered were a few more angry gringos. In the morning, over breakfast, Marston and Patash ran through the possibilities. The raid had been a failure, that much was clear. But now what? They had to assume that Guzman had gone back into hiding or was already on the run, and that at any minute, the FlexiSpy devices they'd been tracking might, like the Nokias, also go dark. A single botched op, they began to fear, was about to obliterate 3 years of their work. But then the phone rang. It was Rodriguez. The young technician was in his room, looking at the spyware spreadsheets. Though he didn't understand it and couldn't quite explain it, everything seemed normal. Normal how? Marston and Patash wanted to know. Regular normal, Rodriguez said. Normal, normal. The flow of messages, the GPS locations. None of it had changed. The agent's disappointment flipped into bewilderment. What they should have been seeing, had expected to see, was a flurry of activity on FlexiSpy. Panicked texts about troops busting in on the condo complex. Orders issued to dump communications. Some kind of movement, however slight, in the kingpin's coordinates. But there was none of that. Not even a hint. It didn't make sense. But the data was the data, and the kid was right. The data looked normal. The little red hombre hadn't moved. It didn't make sense. On the morning after the raid, Vasquez went back to his man in Guadalajara, but even when he ran the pin again, the pin was still there in the exact same place. Mira, he said, referring Vasquez to the map. El hombre rojo, mira. Yeah, Vasquez almost told him. Fuck your hombre rojo. There wasn't anything there. The embassy was scratching its collective head. Some agents theorized the pin was bad. Others, that their man in Guadalajara was taking them for a ride. Whatever it was, Vasquez figured that Chapo Guzman was the luckiest pendejo in Mexico. But the thing was this. He had to be lucky all the time. They only had to be lucky once. After his colleagues had run out of theories, Vasquez called the one man who could help him sort it out. Brian Maxwell of the United States Marshals Service, was the leader of a classified tracking team that had been working in Mexico for nearly a decade. Maxwell, everyone called him B. Max, was an expert in both finding fugitives and bringing them in, and had taken part in countless snatch-and-grab operations against major cartel chieftains. B. Max's specialty was signals, surveillance, and counter-surveillance, which meant he got to see not only the government's most secret tools for hunting miscreants, but some of the tools that the miscreants used to get away. When Vasquez told him about the little red man, Maxwell had his own theory. Their source in Guadalajara had probably pinged Guzman's BlackBerry number off a cell tower. But cell tower pings were notoriously hard to read and weren't always accurate. They often gave a general perimeter, not a precise location. Maxwell had his own means of homing in on such locations and was happy to give it a try. Even with the help, Vasquez didn't want to leave a stone unturned. After signing off with B-Max, he went upstairs in the embassy to see his cousins in Central Intelligence. He said he had a BlackBerry he was looking for. Perhaps, he asked, they might consider putting a plane in the air and helping him track it down. By late that night, or early next morning, the pair of stones that Vasquez overturned revealed the same worm, a new target. This one looked to be a 20-minute drive from the last one and lay at the edge of the perimeter in which the little red man had been standing. It was another, smaller condo complex, a cul-de-sac of sorts, with three houses clumped together at the end of a road looking out across the water. Punta Ballena, it was called. A few hours after the target was discovered, Marston Patash and Rodriguez left Mexico City. The operation over and their work complete, they packed their bags, hopped a plane, and flew back to New York. It was only when they landed and the embassy reached out to them that they received the news. The mission to capture Guzman had continued, was continuing. Back in Culiacan, Emma was worried about him. She had heard bad news and sent a text. 2:40 p.m. Honey, some guys in La Guadalupe Victoria were killed just now. Was it any of your people? 2:41 p.m. No, darling. That was a relief. 2:44 p.m. I love you, love. Talk to you soon. She should have been more worried. Less than an hour later, at 3:35 p.m., a smaller strike team of 50 policemen and a dozen more intelligence officers drove up the road toward Punta Ballena. Brian Maxwell was on the ground this time to make sure the job got done. With Maxwell's homing equipment, it wasn't difficult to figure out which house of the three on the cul-de-sac was Guzman's. According to the readings, it was that one over there, the salmon-colored split-level mansion with a red-tiled roof and the large surrounding garden. Driving through the gate, Maxwell sped up the flagstone drive toward the garage. But when he and his team climbed out and turned around, the Mexicans were storming the wrong house. By mistake? It was possible, though it hardly seemed likely given that Maxwell was jumping up and down and waving them back toward the door that he had found. No, amigos, he was shouting. This one, not that one. Aquí, amigos. This one over here. When the police finally broke into the house, the right house, they discovered and arrested three suspects. Angel Jorge Lopez, who claimed to be a pilot, Maria Luisa Macias, who said she was the maid, and a slender, dark-haired woman named Agustina Acosta. A search of the premises revealed a cache of items that seemed to both confirm and refute their accounts. While the officers found a bedroom full of clothes, blue jeans, Nikes, underwear, a baseball hat, they also found an MP5 assault rifle, night vision goggles, and a sports pack filled with hand grenades. What they did not find was Chapo Guzman. Though after the delay by the police, Maxwell had a guess where he had gone. Grabbing one of the officers, he ran out onto the mansion's back deck. Standing near a hedge of potted palms, he stared past the neighbor's yard, toward the blue sweep of the sea. It took a moment to find it, but there it was, behind the fronds, on the far side of the low stone wall that rimmed the swimming pool. A slightly crushed thorn bush and what looked like footsteps on the sandy little path that led down to the beach.